What two considerations were most influential in your decision years ago to commit to seminary and a career in ministry?
What was the beginning? What did you say?
What two considerations?
Two considerations.
So my experience was when I first walked into a Unitarian Universalist congregation when I was 16, I felt this alignment between this thing that I had always been doing as a kid and as a young person, which is trying to create the container for us to have different experiences. And I found in the church that I could do that for the really broad swath of human experiences. So it wasn't limited to just one part of reality. It was inviting our bodies, our spirits, our minds. And so there was like a deep alignment for like who I was before. And then the second consideration before I committed to seminary was I wanted to go somewhere where I wouldn't have a lot of debt. It's practical, but it's real. I wanted to kind of come out of seminary with the freedom to serve the congregation that I felt called to and not the one that I needed to serve because of kind of economic reality, because seminary is really, really expensive.
That was smart, Sean. I didn't think about that latter thing. I think that I would just quickly say for me, the first was a sense that like I didn't have to decide what was going to happen after seminary, and that instead I could say I was really clear that seminary was the right next thing for me to learn and grow as a leader and as a person that I wanted to be in the world. So kind of taking the right next step without having to know the whole story. That was really important for me because it was scary. And I was really skeptical about church. And then the second is I got encouragement from my local congregation. I heard from elders in the church a sense that they saw in me a future minister. And that was something that I, again, it was scary and I wasn't sure what it exactly meant, but their encouragement really made a big difference.
All right, our next question is this. How do you maintain hope in these pandemic and political times?
You want me to go?
Sure.
I think, right now I mean, as a lot of times, I'm not oriented towards hope per se, hope as an optimism. But I am oriented towards a sense that, that my continued showing up matters, and that each day trying to find a sense of, how I can keep being present to the fullness of the world is my general orientation, the fullness that is in the brokenness and the pain and the goodness, and not try to get too stuck on any one of those things. A lot of what we're talking about that in this the orientation of this service is a big part of that, in a sense of remembering that nothing is settled. So that's a big source of hope. And then I see a lot of good. And even though there's a lot that's hard, I also have the chance in my job to see a lot of the goodness in people and the creativity and the persistence and the love that's really present. And I refuse to see just one part. So that gives me hope too.
And I'm also not completely oriented towards hope. I feel like hope can also be paralyzing in the same way that hopelessness can be paralyzing. Hope can sometimes give us, an accepting of things happening really slowly, or accepting of unjust conditions or un real realities. As we kind of hope that things will get better, we just need to endure. In the same way that hopelessness can paralyze us from, you know, actually taking the steps that we can take. I feel like where I'm most grounded, or at least where I would locate, I think what hope does for other people is finding ways to connect with the eternal, you know, what is true beyond reality, beyond the facts on the ground, beyond the news headlines, and finding kind of my grounding in things that are not going to be unstable, like political change, like political climates, and remembering who I am to the universe, who I am to myself. That really allows me to navigate in ways in which I'm not overwhelmed by the true devastation that is now, that is completely right to be hopeless about what is going on, as it is completely right to have hope because of what you see. I think accepting both those realities is really important, and forcing yourself to feel hopeful, or forcing yourself in even to feel hopeless, I think it's not the right prescription. It's more like what grounds you in what is true, but also in what is possible. And so how do you live those two things at the same time?
So our next question, what do Unitarian Universalists believe about spirituality of animals?
That's a great question. It reminds me that we had said maybe we would do a blessing of the animals through this time, and we kind of missed that. So usually we do it in June. We'll have to come back around to that. Well, just a general caveat in any of these sorts of questions, making any kind of generalized statement about what Unitarian Universalists believe is fraught with complexities and contradictions, and there will always be someone who says, but I don't believe that. And actually, that's a good thing. So with that said, I would say, it sounds like what I would say about God. There's a variety of opinions about what Unitarian Universalists believe about spirituality in animals, or the sense of, can we say inherent worth of animal life. And yet I would say that generally our seventh principle of the interdependent web of all existence affirms a sense of deep interconnectedness and an acknowledgement that we, human life, are just a part of that web. And so in that, there's a willingness of a greater, equalization than you might think, and that sometimes I think we don't fully explore. So, and with that said, I bet there's a whole sermon in this, and that Sean and I have talked about the idea of looking at a family systems that includes pets. So in other words, the ways that often our pets manifest what's going on in the rest of our household or our family system, in really interesting ways that we notice when we're working with families, or maybe perhaps in our own lives. So it's another element.
Yeah. It reminds me of that question, like, do dogs go to heaven? Like that question of the, you know, the value of animals in kind of a worldview system. And I think if any of us have had a deep relationship with an animal, we realize the complexities of being connected to someone or a being that has a different way of communicating than we do. And it truly is a relationship. It is a mutual practice in which each of us has different ways of supporting the other, especially thinking of like a pet type relationship. And so I think we would also affirm the relationality between us and the non-animal world, to say that there is value in that relationship, and that it is a mutual relationship and also a complex one. And it, I think, can help us understand dynamics of power and interconnection and care and consent in ways that both mirror and provide illumination for our kind of human systems.
So our next question is, what if you don't believe that all people are worthy of love without exception.
Welcome to the club, most days.
Last night, my mother-in-law was asking me what's the most common question, and at this time and this, this is the most common question for these times. Like, at least the last 4 years, I feel like this has been a really common question. And it used to be that the version of this before that was like, well, does Hitler have inherent worth and dignity? I found that actually, and I used to say, well, let's not start with Hitler. Let's start with your next door neighbor or your brother-in-law that believes differently than you do, or, you know, that whatever, whoever is most, you know, closest in your life that most has the chance to push your buttons. How are you doing on affirming their inherent worth and dignity? I would say actually the last 4 years have, I don't have to make that reminder quite as often anymore, because I feel like these questions are a lot more intimate. And they play out in, which means they're a lot, it's a lot more pressing in terms of the heartbreak of what it means to feel in deep tension about another person's inherent worth or their shared humanity. So as Sean started with, I think it is something that like we all wrestle with, and to not wrestle with it means you're not actually asking the question or clear about its true implications. But my continued response on this question is just that the stance about inherent worth and dignity is less about someone else's humanity and more about your own humanity, and about recognizing in yourself a stance of a willingness to continue to move towards seeing the practice of seeing in another someone like you, and that's a commitment that you can make, and that it takes discipline, but it's a choice of how you're going to live your life, and that sometimes that's harder and sometimes it's easier, but that it really has nothing to do with whether somebody is making good choices or not. That's the inherent part. It's
a sense of timers,
humanity.
I know our timer's up. I think I've been thinking a lot about generational trauma and the ways that pain and hurt is passed down from generation to generation. And it reminds me of that. I mean, it's the last part of that belonging piece, that there is a way in which the violence that is visited upon us because of our actions, the disconnect that we can experience because of what we've done, usually starts in small places. It starts in childhood with adverse childhood experiences. It is magnified in relationships, and the disconnection just becomes more and more wide. And so part of it is a work of repair, that if we are to say that no one is beyond the work of finding a place of belonging, it helps to bring into the fold, into our community, those who have experienced trauma and who are acting that trauma out in the ways that they are hurting others in a way that then repairs it. So it's also a stance that is reparative and reminds us that we are creatures of our environment as much as we are creatures with full free will. And so we cause many of the situations that lead to these sorts of actions. And so it's our responsibility to do the work to minimize the harm, but also invite back in for future generations.
All right, welcome back to round two, Gretchen and Sean. Your next question is this. I feel like my life is too busy for a daily spiritual practice. What thoughts do you have on why I should consider it and how I can make it happen?
Well, you answered your own question, because your life feels too busy for a spiritual practice, and thus you should take one up. You know, the advice that we give around spiritual practice is that it has three components. It's any practice that you do with intentionality, regularity, and depth. So this is, you know, part of the conundrum when we feel busy is we can't think about adding yet another thing. And the first thing is to say, actually, sometimes adding something like this can actually give you more capacity. I know that when I am regular with my meditation, my centering prayer, with my daily examined, that I am present to my life and I'm able to use my capacity so much better and more grounded. But the other part is that it doesn't necessarily mean adding something. It could mean taking an experience you already have and bringing a new intention in, inviting a more rhythmic nature to it so that it's a pattern, and then finding a depth of connection, not only to yourself, but maybe to others, and to that which is greater than all of us. You know, there's that saying, on the days that I can't meditate for 30 minutes, I do it for an hour. You know, that there's a way in which these practices are really important to who we are. But because we're Unitarian Universalists, we should reframe what they are so it doesn't feel like you need to be praying or meditating for it to count. I think Elaine was saying to me that someone said to her, what if you think of this as play? Which I thought was a really great reframe. So instead of thinking it needs to be this serious discipline, what if it was something that you're playing, you know, an activity that you got to actually brought you joy, you know, that it's, it maybe seems too far from, maybe seems too much, but actually maybe that's just the frame that you're living with.
Yeah, I think the main, my I have two responses to that question. The first is me too. And the second is start smaller. So don't worry about a half an hour practice or a 15 minute practice. Start with a 5 minute practice and then a 6 minute practice and just start smaller.
All right. Two of my heroes fell from grace due to charges of sexual abuse. True story. It broke my heart. I'm getting through it, but it is slow. Must it be slow? Or do you have thoughts that could help?
Must it be slow? Yes. I mean, it must be the time it takes, and there's no rushing grief, which is a lot of that experience of trying to piece together who you thought somebody is and then who they are. And that is kind of the work of trying to re-piece together someone into a whole person, which you know, most folks are not as amazing and as we think they are, and most are not as terrible as we think they are either. That we all hold pieces of brokenness and the potential for hurting others in us, and that part of the work is allowing for the fullness of that truth to be held about people that we've held kind of a further on one side about. So I think my main answer is it will take the time that it will take. And the thing that will help is staying with it and remembering that it's all work of love.
All right. What is most important to live by, loyalty or integrity?
Are those two things different? I guess it's like that. I think the question is about
self or other,
right? Orienting to self or orienting to others. Yeah, I think the most important is to find the place of overlap between those two. Maybe that's it. I'm like avoiding the question, but I mean, to me, that's covenant is the place where those things overlap. And so finding the place where you, the loyalties that you have are also resonant with a deep sense of integrity. If you're loyal without integrity, then you may have chosen the wrong loyalties. If you have integrity without a sense of loyalty, I mean, you might be a narcissist. So, I mean, right. I mean that if all your integrity is about yourself, without promises to others and their needs, you might have too much self going on in your covenant.
Yeah, there might be a piece of this, though. Thinking about integrity, like one of the dark sides of integrity is like absolutism and perfectionism, like a sense of like a personal need to be correct, to be without stain, to be always morally and ethically good, versus maybe an orientation to loyalty can invite us towards more complexity and understanding that when we are moving towards a goal or an orientation towards the other, it can invite us into the gray realities of life. But I mean, I think these are two really important concepts to really have in tension, because as Gretchen said, there's a way in which one without the other is either too internal facing or denying the self. And I think that's why when we talk about covenant, we talk about, or courageous love, we talk about a love of self, a love of other, and a love of the whole world, that there's a way in which integrity, loyalty, and then that sense of connectedness between all, puts a stable organizing principle to figure out, or at least to wrestle with, how those two, the tensions inherent in that should be resolved. So I wouldn't pick one or the other, but I do think it's important to know like which of those pushes your buttons. Like I would say for me, I am an Enneagram 5 with a 6 wing, which if you know Enneagram means that loyalty is really big to you. And so it super pushes my buttons when I don't think people are being loyal. Like you made a commitment, you're part of an organization. It may not be the thing you like, but we're a part of this together. And I also I can't empathize as readily with folks who really have that deep sense of integrity of like, if I don't do this, according to that really deepest sense of myself, then I'm going to be out of step. And so I think it's important just to know which of them also is a trigger for you or activates you, because I think it creates a lot of conflict in relationships. And I can see that dynamic in our community, in our larger community, and in myself.
So our next question is, who are some inspiring UU authors to read from? And I would also offer if there are other UU figures who people could follow or otherwise engage with that you'd like to share, please throw those in too.
Did I make a sound like I had an answer? Let's see. Well, my way into Unitarian Universalism, like the where I started to feel like I was finding the depth, was through Rebecca Parker. So like I just think she's a like most of her writing, it's really accessible, but also starts to point towards a greater depth. So if you haven't read her work, I would encourage that. A lot of her work is based in the work of James Luther Adams, who is a little denser in his work, but also rich. I just was pointing the board towards Mark Morrison Reed's work for some historical work on Unitarian Universalism, particularly around Black Unitarian Universalist history. So those are some that I just some beginning places that. And maybe Sean has some ideas about current voices we might want to encourage you to. Oh, you're on mute, Sean.
I was just running away to go get some books. So I would encourage everyone to start exploring Breaking and Blessing, which is a meditation manual from the Reverend Sharon Parker Dennison, their Unitarian Universalist minister. And you know, each year the UUA puts out a wonderful meditation manual from someone within our tradition, and they're really powerful. And I think it's a way of connecting through poetry and prose that is accessible and imaginative in a way that kind of the dense texts can sometimes feel disconnecting. But if you are into dense texts, if you want to borrow or check out these two wonderful books, which is the Documentary Histories of Unitarian Universalism, which is kind of an annotated exploration of the different major texts or moments in Unitarian Universalism. And so they have the primary sources and then some exposition. It's a really wonderful way of kind of getting to know our history from, in other words, the people who are a part of that. And the last plug I'll give is the work of Dan McCannon and Prophetic Encounters. Dan is a historian and scholar and one of my teachers at seminary, and he explores the role of religion impacting the American religious tradition, especially progressives. And so he really expands in the ways that sometimes we give away the religious voice to the religious right. And he says that actually progressives have been deeply intertwined in not only secular religious movements and justice movements, but religious justice movements, and finding the resonance is really important.
We're out of time.